Master percussionist Ray Barreto with one of his signature tunes, Power. It's the title track of his award-winning 1972 album, Barreto Power. And he's a special, still carries a special rhythm with me, because I loved his music up until he died in 2006 at the age of 76. His ashes were scattered in the two places that were close to his heart, certainly in Puerto Rico, where he was born, and in New York, where he lived for a long time and did much of his musical work. This is Lead Stories. I'm Beatrice Lead. And today, we are going to go to Puerto Rico to follow up on something I had raised last week and early this week. And that is the plight of Puerto Rico, special plight of Puerto Rico, suffering under not just the coronavirus, but the virulent virus of neglect and corruption. We have as our guest today someone who had been with us for quite a while, guiding us through some of the complicated issues affecting Puerto Rico, and she's with us again today. I'm delighted to have her. You know, the funny thing is we have never met. We have never seen each other. We have never met. We've never shaken hands. But I feel like she's my sister. Her name? What is your name? Could you please introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Elisa Yenza.
And what do you do in Puerto Rico? What have you been doing all these years in Puerto Rico?
I've been a journalist for many years. I worked with Script Howard's newspaper, the San Juan Star, for 5 years when it had just changed hands. And I've also do investigation reporting, and I work with a group of scientists. I help them out. They're alternative medicine scientists, investigators that work with different therapies that are natural in nature to handle different things, and I keep on freelancing, and I also do a lot of community work, and I'm an environmental activist, so it seems to be different, but they're all related, because for you to be healthy, you have to have a healthy environment, so those things have to go together, and that's what I do, and, you know, try to keep up with everything and help as much as I can, because this is a wonderful place to live in on the island. And, you know, some people have been doing things that are not the right thing for the island and for the people that live here. So I try to do as much as I can so that my children and my grandchildren can have, you know, space here to live and in a nice way.
Well, as you know, you have been very, very helpful to us on this program regarding the issues, political, social, economic, affecting the people of Puerto Rico, and by extension, the Puerto Rican population in the United States as well. So it's been, you've been doing double duty with us, and I thank you so much for all that you have done with us and hopefully will continue to do.
Oh, I thank you so much for the opportunity. And I think it's really important that we all outreach to help each other, you know, even those that are not have any ties with Puerto Rico, because as I say, it's a planet and we all live here and we need to help each other. And it's been very nice to see that people that haven't even been here feel and are interested in what's going on with us. That is something that is I'm really grateful for, because, you know, we by ourselves are very limited sometimes to get things done correctly. And when people from out of Puerto Rico show an interest in us and start moving things, things happen. Good things happen.
Right. So let's start with the latest. And from my perspective, well, you would correct the perspective if you think it is not the right perspective. But from my perspective, it is that Puerto Rico right now is dealing with a double whammy. It's had two things assailing it: the coronavirus, which is one thing, but the previous virus and continuing virus of corruption, and the ill treatment and the neglect of the people themselves. Let's talk about that first, if you don't mind. Since the hurricane, and you had taken us inside of that story, since the hurricane, we have, the last count I read was 800,000 or 80,000. I'm not sure if they misplaced a zero there. But there are that many homes still in a terrible state of disrepair. Roofs have not been replaced. Repairs have not been made. The U.S. federal government that promised to come through has not. What is the situation with housing?
Well, right now with housing, as you say, there's many more houses that are not fixed, but we have 30,000, and it's a calculation, because part of the problem we have with the government is that they don't take statistics correctly. So we can't really fix things if you don't have the numbers, exact numbers to evaluate. And that's been an issue with the COVID cases now. But there's an estimated over 30,000 homes that have blue tarps on their roofs, and nothing has been done to fix them. And the very current new thing right now is that we're under a tropical storm warning right now. There's a hurricane coming over. It's calculated that it's going to go right through the same path that Maria went. And it's not as strong right now, but you can imagine what's going on here since the last 2 days, because people are hysterical. The stores were packed in a few places yesterday, lines, because people wanted to get their supplies. And the least that we can expect is a lot of rain, unless something very drastic happens and it deviates completely. But it's supposed to be, the center of this thing is supposed to pass right through Yabucoa, where they usually come through the east, the east coast, the towns that receive most of the things that come from Africa. So that's the newest things. And you can imagine what it's like for people that have a little few amount of things that they've been able to save or replace, and they're living under the tarps, when you have a calculation that maybe up to 8 or 10 inches of rain is the least that they're expecting that would happen if it's not very stormy as far as winds are concerned. So it's very difficult, you know. And then we have the earthquakes came, so the south of the island have an additional situation, though some people don't even have a home anymore, because even though they had the tarp, now they can't use the house because it's a risk for the earthquakes. And then with the social distancing, they're still trying to figure out in the South now where they can have shelters, because the schools used to be the shelters and they're not safe anymore with the earthquake. So it's very complicated. And when you don't have a government that's focused correctly and that has the experience and that's willing to work from the bottom up, they don't consider grassroots for anything. They impose everything they think is what they have to do. They don't consult. They don't. They're not in touch with the people, and that's a problem. Because when Maria happened, we were alone. There was no way the government could. We didn't even have communication, so people had to rely on themselves and their neighbors and do things the first, you know, the first few, because there was no communication, no traveling, no nothing. And they haven't even organized people so that they can have the tools they need to take care of themselves the first few days if something else happens. And that's really bad, because there are resources in the government to do that. There's funds for that, and there's people that have already done it other places. And when you see that people on the top are not organizing that way, it's very concerning, you know. I mean, people feel very unsafe. They don't trust the government anymore. And then when you don't trust the government, you don't follow their instructions, you know, and then that creates other situations.
I saw yesterday that the head of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which normally comes into play in situations of disaster, either prior to disaster or after disaster, admitting that they've done a rotten job in Puerto Rico. That doesn't help. The fact is, they've done a rotten job. And they've had 3 years to respond, but did not respond to the obvious need. How do people get away with this kind of flimsy excuse to say, well, yes, we admit we didn't perform up to par, or we didn't do our job? Should that not mean that they should be gone?
Well, I think part of the problem with FEMA is, and we know that they have bureaucratic situations, and there have been complaints in other places in the country. This is not new. And we know that there are disaster corporations that come in, and the needs of those corporations are usually what dominate when nobody else is in place, right? But besides all that, there has been a lot of resources assigned to Puerto Rico, but I think that sometimes things are not done properly. And then the other thing is that they're supposed to receive petitions from the local government, and then they try to fill them in. It's not like they're supposed to come in here and impose a plan. The local government should be telling them, this is what's happening here, and these are our needs. And then FEMA has to help the local government supply those needs. But when you have a government, when Trump came here, the governor insisted we only had 16 people dead after the hurricane. And, you know, then Trump said, well, you know, this is great. This is, you know, Katrina was a real disaster. Puerto Rico is fine, you know. They didn't even want to admit for reasons we really don't understand. Because if you have a situation like the hurricane that's not your fault, right, any damage that it's done, you can just speak out and claim it. Because unless you can have somebody come up and say, it's your fault this happened, then you're free. But they wanted to give the impression that they had everything under control here. And they insisted, when people kept on telling them from the bottom, from the grassroots, from the townships, that things were not going well, that there were people dying, that people didn't know where to take the bodies of their dead ones because funeral parlors that had no electricity, they weren't receiving bodies, hospitals were full. I mean, we had wagons at the end there where they do the autopsies. Some of them weren't even refrigerated. It was like a total thing, like a bizarre thing from a terrifying movie of some kind. Things that you don't think would happen in United States territory, which is supposed to be the most advanced country in the world, you know. And we're part of the United States since 1898. For good or for bad, that's the situation. and all the rules and the safety regulations that you have in the United States apply here. I mean, it's not a foreign country. You know, it's just overseas, which is very difficult for us to communicate with the United States when it has to be physical and you have a hurricane in the middle of the ocean. Your barges, your boats don't bring things in. Communications can be cut. So if we don't have things here in advance, which is what usually happens, then we have to sit to wait, and as time goes by, it gets worse. So, and the other thing I think happened, FEMA, we have the information that FEMA imported around 22,000 people to work here with the crisis, and we had a lot of unemployed professionals with master's degrees and all the expertise necessary to do all the footwork and the coordination down here, and it created an additional hazard in the sense that you had to find housing for those people. You had the airlines occupying air flights for those people coming in and out. You had to give them transportation, food, and everything else, when you could have just trained the people here and then had a fleet of people for the future that were trained that could take over immediately until the federal government could come in and do its job. So, but I come again, I think that if the local government says, we'll do what FEMA says we have to do, and they don't have initiatives and a plan, then everything in a crisis can go really bad, you know, because there's not a, no, there's nobody leading with the knowledge and the direction necessary to handle things like this. And, you know, Utris, the climate is really a thing that you can't predict even a little bit, like you used to at least be able to know some things, but it's going crazy all over the world. So we have to start thinking about always having things up to date and have a plan for anything, because there's no excuse to say, oh, this is an unprecedented event. Well, that's what good leaders are supposed to be able to do. Have the imagination and the criteria necessary to improvise when something arises that they've never dealt with. And that's what happened, that, you know, we had a young governor with no experience in government. He wasn't listening to the people that we have, our own emergency agency here. He dismantled everything. He had a plan that was left by people in the past. He didn't even recruit the old guys that knew more. They even got rid of this guy that he's in charge now, but they took him out for political reasons. They sat him on a desk, and he's the one with the most expertise in rescue operations on the island. And they you know, annulled him in a corner because of political reasons. And they put people there that were political favors and people that didn't know what they had to do. So it got really bad. And it's not really any better right now. You know, we've been lucky that we haven't had another hurricane for 3 years, but this thing that's it's called Isaac, and it's moving up towards us straight. And so, you know, I mean,
Has there been an official count of how many people actually died as a result of the last hurricane?
No, the numbers that we have is 4,000. I can't remember. I think it's 40,265 people. That one of the studies were done by a university in the United States. There was another one that did another calculation. And this is another thing that's totally ridiculous. We had the people here to do the count. We didn't have to pay $500,000 to one of the universities to come do this. Because when they come, what they do is they have to go to the public agencies because they don't have any information. So they had to go to demographics agency. They had to go to pathology. They had to go to the police department. They had to go to every place where they could get the data. And we could have done that with our own agencies, and we could have left that money in the University of Puerto Rico, who has the professionals and all the departments to handle statistics and everything else. But this is part of the corruption problem that we're having. Handouts for companies and organizations that have some kind of affiliation with the politicians in power. And we've even seen that some nonprofits were formed to take this money that was being donated to help people, you know, here the private donations were channelized through this organization that originally was formed by the first lady that was Ricardo Rosselló's wife. And they started collecting, you know, everybody went crazy in the United States when they saw the films that we could not see because we had no television and we had no electricity. But people were seeing horrifying scenes and they wanted to help. And the money was funneled that way. And we have not really received a detailed relationship of how the funds were used. Some of them were given to organized, established organizations that already existed that have their own fundraising. But we don't really know where the money went because we haven't seen the results, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's still going on. Just today they found a new lot with a whole bunch of containers with supplies for emergencies. Just today, I haven't even had a chance to get into the news. But they found another place where they have, you know, this is something the government does. They store them away in those transportation containers that come overseas. And they park them somewhere, and then all of a sudden somebody finds them and finds out what they are, and they publish them on social media, and that's how we find out that, hey, what's this, you know? So it's very difficult. And when the earthquake happened, that's one of the things that happened. People didn't have – we had the first few nights. People were sleeping literally on the road in parking lots on top of the asphalt. Open sky, because there was nothing the first few days. And then we find out that we had a whole lot of cots and tarps and things that were stored away in this big storage space. A government rented out to a private storage company. And so people got really mad, and they opened the door, and the citizens started, you know, making a line, and they were handing out what they had in there. They were Pampers and baby milk and water and all kinds of things. And people didn't have any of that. And the government was dragging their feet on it. So people took their own power and did it. And they were going to accuse people. And then people started, you dare accuse this guy that let us know, you know, because we're going to defend him. But it's really crazy because we're talking about life and death here. And people that already have an issue. They're already poor for generations. They don't have the best nutrition to begin with. They don't have the right medical care. So when you don't even have the bare necessity to survive, it becomes very bad, you know, a crisis. And Puerto Rico also happens to be one of the highest diabetes territories in the world. So when you need a refrigeration for your insulin and you can't just eat any kind of food that they have, you know, you're not supposed to be eating a lot of carbohydrates of prepared foods and canned stuff and all that. It's, you know, you can do that a few days, but you can't do that for months. I mean, you know, it's really hard to describe, and it's frustrating when you're trying to help and you. Puerto Rico's at a point right now, Beatriz, where you wake up every morning at 6 o'clock and the radio programs that are up there, they're presenting 10 new things that we didn't know were happening the day before. Two or three more corruption cases. The FBI just went in for the third time in the last month and raided somebody and one of the House of Representatives elected officials. This is the third one that has his telephone taken away. And they're investigating what they call ghost employees, people that are supposed to be getting paid, but nobody has seen them working in sight. And, you know, it's in the budget, but the budgets are not open. So you just have a general figure how much money they have to pay salaries. And somebody seems to have found out that that there were people there that weren't working and were getting paid. And so there's a whole federal investigation going on with that. They've even broken their tradition of not getting involved close to a primary, not doing that, this kind of thing. So the FBI here asked for permission from what they've said to Washington to go ahead and do this investigation in the middle of a primary that we have on the 9th of August. That's how bad it is. The governor's in under investigation also. The Wanda Vasquez is
okay. Besides you, who Who is not under investigation? It seems to be the easier way to answer the question. You and who else might be the only ones not being investigated?
Well, there's a lot of people that are not investigated and that are not being taken care of or listened to, you know.
Has Dr. Ben Carson, the head of the Housing and Urban Development for the federal government, has he been to Puerto Rico?
No, he hasn't. And it's terrible in the sense that a lot of the federal funds for reconstruction, even things that have nothing to do with public housing, they want to funnel them through the Department of Housing, the local Department of Housing, who was in charge of the first program they had for emergency. It was called the STEP, and in Spanish they put the name Tu Hogar Renace, your home, Renaissance home. And it was a disaster because they gave a big contract to administer to a company who had never done it and wasn't the one that was supposed to take the public bid because the other one had the qualifications and took the government to court. But even though they won the case, the other company continued. And then that company was in charge of administration, and they had seven companies that took over by region the reconstruction in an emergency way. It was supposed to give a security safety to the people so they could go back to their dwelling and live there, even though part of the house was not working. They closed down the part that wasn't able to live in. They cleaned the mold. They'd make sure your bathroom was okay, that you had some form of electricity, and they'd repair one window in each room and close the other one so that you could be safe, you know, under climate conditions. But that was another disaster. There's a lot of things and complaints going on with that. And one of the instructions we had is that anybody that had a blue tarp could not have their roof fixed. And this was all done under our local housing department. And they're in charge now of all the federal funds that are coming. I can't remember the names. Fondo CDBG, CDBG fund. They're the ones that are going to be approving what's going to be done and supposed to be coordinating, but it's all delayed. And this is the other thing. You keep on, it's not like the federal government is totally ignoring us. We have funds assigned to us. It's just that they never get put in motion. They're just assigned, and we keep on getting announcements from the resident commissioner that says that she got this and that for Puerto Rico, but we don't see, you know, where's the beef? You don't see things happening. And it's really, you know, like, it's really terrible. And then when besides the fact that it directly hurts us to have people that aren't doing their job or are corrupt, it also gives an excuse to President Trump, who says that the people of Puerto Rico are good people, but their government is corrupt. So, you know, it doesn't help. You know what I mean? It doesn't help that the local people in charge are not, they should be so straight, but they're not. I mean, the governor's going around, we have the COVIDs here, and we were locked in since March the 15th with a curfew. We could only go to drugstores and supermarkets, and we have to be in our homes by 9 o'clock. And we have this alarm that comes out every day, like half an hour before. It's a buzzer that comes and tells you, you have warning, it's, you know, time to get home. We have to protect ourselves from COVID and all this, wear your mask. And so we were locked in there for 90 days, practically. This was the thing that was going on. And, but we don't see now that they've been opening, like the government wasn't ready to receive government workers back. Places weren't reconstructed to guarantee distancing within government facilities. So we have an election coming, and the Junta de Control Fiscal, the board that was assigned to Puerto Rico under PROMESA to manage the finances of Puerto Rico, is not letting the money out in time for the election commissioner to get things in place. He needs to rent out places for voting because we don't have we can't use some of the schools. Some of them are too small. People need to be separated so that we don't have a crisis with the virus. And everything is like, you know, last minute. We don't get anything till the very last minute, so everything's improvised in a lot of cases, and it's just weird, you know. It shouldn't be happening. It shouldn't be. There are monies, and shouldn't. You know, I know.
And it should be. It should be a focal point. It should be a major focal point in Congress, because they know that Puerto Rico is experiencing tragedy after tragedy. And the people are being pushed to the edge and even over the edge in trying to just deal with this. Let me ask you about what is going on in light of the coronavirus. How could an island pushed to the limit, as you've been describing, how is it able to respond in any way to the coronavirus?
Well, when the whole thing started, first of all, we're under the CDC and the Department
the
of Health
for Disease
of the United
Control.
States, right? And the health and the United States Health Department. So when the whole thing started, we were like on standby because the CDC was under Trump, and Trump said this was fraud and there was nothing, it was a hoax. So things weren't done. Then when the testing started coming out, it could only be testing from the CDC. So we had no other testing we could do here. And then when they finally sent the kits that were also sent to the states were had defects in it. So they didn't even send enough, but the ones they sent had problems with it. So until they finally decided that the health departments of each state were going to be in charge, nothing was done here. And then when they start doing it, they have a whole technical thing where you just can't buy the reactors and start doing testing. You have to do some testing within your lab, but you have to have a certain amount of positive cases and negative cases that you are going to test and make sure that your testing is exactly the result of the CDC. So if you don't have the people that are sick and already confirmed as positive, you have to wait for somebody to send you samples of people that are positive so you can work on it. And the whole thing drags on for a long time. Then we had this corruption going on with we've had three health secretaries in all one in a row, because the one that was in January who said we didn't have to worry because China was far away from Puerto Rico did nothing. That was our local version of disaster. He didn't take it seriously. He said we didn't have to worry. China was too far away. So he did nothing. Then he resigned, and we had his subsecretary was in for a week and a half. And then we had this whole thing with corruption with buying the testing, like $38 million were being bought from a construction company who had a connection to buy these tests at an outrageous price. And the whole scandal broke up. So then that woman left the secretary because she wasn't willing to do certain things that she was being pressured by the central government. And now we have a new secretary in place who was a secretary in the past. He's a psychiatrist. And he's trying to fix things, but we don't have to this point an effective database where we can know exactly what's happening. We don't have a contact tracing system from the central government implied. Small towns have been doing it. But the data is constantly changed, the way everything is managed. There were plans to take an old hospital and prepare it just for COVID. That hasn't come out. At the beginning, they canceled all the non-essential operations in all hospitals on the island. So it got to the point where hospitals were like at a 30% occupancy rate, and they were complaining that they could not administer and run a hospital with only 30% of the revenue coming in. So that became a problem. Hospitals fired a lot of their nurses and personnel because they didn't have anybody to take care of. We don't know at this point if they're all back working. There was the money coming in from CARES that they gave, you know, people that weren't working salaries. Plus, the governor had an incentive put in with part of the money that was that they had to give medical personnel a $3,000, $4,000 incentive. But a lot of our nurses and other personnel went to the United States to work, and a few of them got sick. in the United States working with the patients. And now we had lowered our numbers because even though they never closed the airport, less people were coming and everybody was locked up. So you had the numbers were so low that they said, we passed the peak and we stabilized this. We're ready to open for business. And they opened everything all of a sudden around May the 22nd. And that has been chaos because we have days where we have up to 9,000 people coming in every day at the Luis Muñoz Marin Airport. And there was one day in particular 3 weeks ago that the National Guard, who's in charge of monitoring people that come in, they reported 30,000 people just one day. So that week in particular, it ran up to over 80,000 people coming in. There's no way that how many people do you need to at the entrance of the airport to check every single person? And now they have a new requisite since July the 15th that you have to come in with a negative test that must be 72 days or less, 72 hours or less that you to have the test done for COVID. And it has to be negative or you have to spend 14 days in quarantine in Puerto Rico. But you come here as a tourist and you say you're going to stay in your hotel room, and who's going to check you out and make sure you didn't leave your hotel room? So now we are, the cases, the local cases are rising in Puerto Rico. Just today we had like six or seven people were reported have died, which is very unusual because it wasn't that kind of numbers. When we had it was one or two people every day they reported. And it's not only the tourists that are coming in that have nothing to do from Puerto Rico. We have a lot of people that live in the United States and come during the summer to spend time with their family, and that they have been coming here because July is the local vacation month. We have three holidays, and so people just take the long weekends and add their vacation days and have a family vacation. And people come from the States to hang out with the family members. So now we're having clusters of people that received family members from Florida and from other places where they're very high in cases. And now we're starting to see, you know, a whole family here, several family members in another place that were all, you know, sharing with this person that came from Florida, from Texas, or from wherever. And there's no way we can, because it's a federal jurisdiction, the airport can't be closed. We wouldn't want to close the whole thing, you know, but we can't avoid people coming. So then the airlines are giving out tickets at $10, $20 one way. I mean, so it doesn't help when you're getting those kinds of deals, and a lot of people are willing to take a chance or even just come here and have fun. We also had a few doctors report that people came knowing they were sick because we had a low rate of hospital occupancy because they wanted to make sure they could be treated. And there was one guy that needed dialysis, and he was having a hard time in New York, and he was COVID positive, so he came down here with his wife. And, you know, that can become very dangerous. We don't have that many facilities to handle this kind of thing. We don't have enough respirators and ventilators in case of an emergency. There's like about 250 left available right now in the hospitals. We don't even know for sure. These numbers come from people that say different things that are affiliated to the hospital industry. But there's not an official thing where you can rely on. In you know, so it's very terrifying. I mean, I try to keep myself safe and my family safe, and I take all the measures I can. I can't continue to be locked up full time. So when I go out, I'm careful. I try to go out for the minimum. But I have my own car, you know. I have my own ways of moving. But there are thousands of people here who don't have transportation, and the buses haven't been running since March 15th. So people can't even get to their jobs, the ones that have been called into work. They need to have somebody that's going to take them. And it's very complicated. It's very complicated. They closed down without really thinking. There weren't things put in place. elder people are left alone, and since they're the most vulnerable, they're not supposed to be going out. So if they don't have somebody to help them, they're practically, you know, isolated without help. And it's very frustrating, you know, for
what's the prognosis for children going back to school?
Right now, last week, they finally announced that they were going to be fully online. The private schools have been doing, some of them that have, you know, economical means for it, and they're people that are middle and high income usually have their kids in private schools here. But the regular people were finishing the semester online, which was a disaster because we're talking about an island that doesn't even have Wi-Fi guaranteed all over the island, and poor people usually only have their cell phone with Wi-Fi. And some of the phones don't even have a good signal for Wi-Fi in the mountains. So most people could not comply. Parents are not savvy enough to understand the internet enough to help the kids use the machines. We didn't have them educated with laptops or anything before, so they had to kind of learn. If somebody got hold of a tablet or something, or had a equipment that they used to play with, they would use what they had, but they weren't compatible. It was a disaster. And now they're going to go totally online. The Secretary of Education said that he expects that by November, every child will have a computer. But what happens with them if they're starting in August? They're going to print out some paper modules like workbooks or something, but they have to connect some way with the teachers. And we're talking about teachers that make around $2,500 a month. They don't have the money. I mean, they've already been for years buying paint to paint their classroom and buy the materials, and they use their own printers because we've had problems for many years with economics here. And it's not necessarily because we don't have the funds. It's the way the department has been managed. But they can, you know, teachers are working double now because now the parents have their cell phone and they'll call at any hour. And they really want their students to try to get the work done that they were finishing the semester. So they were investing the time. Some teachers, when Maria happened and the earthquake, went out and set up tarps and, you know, like little tents and tried to get their students together before the epidemic. Now with the epidemic, you can't do that. So it's been very, very hard for them, you know, to and we have a total disaster with children with special needs because a lot of the children they can't even communicate well with the computer. So there's no practical plan. They say they're going to take care of it and that they're going to have their therapies, that it's going to be up to the private companies that give these therapies to the children to establish the correct way to give them their therapies. But, you know, it didn't happen last semester. I mean, these are children that need physical therapy. They need, you know, their motor system is messed up. They have vision problems that they need to take care of. And I'm just very, it's very sad because, you know, besides the fact that we do get money from the United States to manage things, and many times they're returned because they didn't use them correctly and they were just standing there. There's a lot of political thing going on. You know that our Secretary of Education was removed and she's in federal court right now. She's being processed for not administering public funds correctly. But the guy that's in place now was second in command with her. And so a lot of the contracts and the things that were being moved in the department, this thing of privatizing everything and contracting everything from teachers, social workers, and psychologists, and then all the equipment, the learning things, is very bad because you can't control what private companies do, and there's no way to monitor them. So at the end there, the children are the ones that pay the price. It was better when the school had its full-time social worker and full-time psychologist that were there for years, and they knew the community and they know the family structure of each child. And they, when the next kid comes in and starts the school, they know what the family situation is, and they come the next year. So, you know, when a child starts, has problems in their home or violence or whatever, they don't trust people at the beginning. You have to develop a relationship with somebody you're treating in therapy. And if they change every year with a new company that got the contract, then that's never accomplished. So, I mean, people, there's a major depression in the South. The mayor just said today that his whole town is a collective depression because with the earthquake, they're living, you know, they've lost their homes. They don't have school since January. Those children in the South have not had any classes since January. So everybody's concerned. It's really, you know, it's really bad.
Well,
I would like to say that Grijalva, who's the president of the Natural Resources Commission in the House of Representatives of the United States, he's very concerned, and he's been trying to even change the PROMESA law to take away some of the powers from the people that are in that in the board, because they're interfering so severely with some of the things that are being done here that they won't let us. You know, laws have been passed and they reverse the laws. They don't approve the budget, so we're not getting things taken care of, in part because their main objective is to get the bonds paid. And so their objective is for us to not spend the money we need to spend here for what's needed. So Grijalva and a group of people in the United States Congress have been trying to change things. But it's a very complicated issue because they have to have everybody on board. They need people from the Republican side to agree. And that's part of the issue, that the way things are handled, we're stuck. You know,
how do you maintain a sense of optimism and hope? You've just spent the last almost an hour giving us every reason why people should just, you know, drown themselves in the sea because everything is wrong.
Well,
what keeps you going? What keeps you hopeful that things could change?
Well, there are groups of people, and sometimes they're being accused of being radical terrorists, socialists, communists, whatever, just like they have accused Carmen Yulín, who people in the United States know our mayor, because she stood up and protested, and some people here because she thinks in the social aspect of how to help people. They consider her, you have to be careful because she's friends with Cuba and Venezuela. So, but there's a real nice group of people, the social workers here, the community organizers and people from churches that have been giving the fight. That event that we had last year, which just is celebrating now the anniversary, it was not organized by any big organization. People just got fed up with what was happening last year, and when they saw this chat where the people in government were making fun of our situation, and you know, we knew that they didn't have a heart to help, but then they put it in writing in their chat texting that they were doing, and everybody just went out on the streets, and people say between 500 or 1 million people were out on the expressway. And the governor resigned because of the pressure that he had. Those people are still trying to make a difference, and we still think that we can make the change. It's very hard because everybody's struggling so much economically, and the daily living is hard. But, you know, it's either that or, you know, shoot yourself in the head, I mean, in some way, because if you don't... Luckily, the Puerto Rican people are very, they have spiritual and religious beliefs that hold them together. They have this, right now the storm is coming and everybody says, que sea lo que Dios quiera, que Dios nos cuide, which means, you know, let it be what God wants and God protect us. So I think that strength that people have in their communities and their religion have helped them hold together, even though it's very, as you say, it's like a miracle itself, right? But people are getting tired. And then some of them just can't collaborate because their daily life has made it so complicated that they don't have the time right now to go out again on the streets with a COVID in place, where, you know, if you get too close to somebody where there's a lot of people, you have a you have a risk of getting contaminated. So there's other things that people are doing. We have a caravan that was organized for this weekend, for Saturday and Sunday, where people are going to remain in their cars, and they have a whole map that's going to go all around the island, and they're going to be passing the baton. It's just commemorating what we did last summer, and letting the politicians know that it's not over, that we're coming for the rest of the ones that are not supposed to be in power and that have messed up our country. So they're starting, and they're going all around, and they're passing the baton physically from the next group that's been going to be waiting. It's a two-day event. Everybody's going to remain in their cars to avoid any kind of problem with contamination. Now we don't know, with this hurricane coming. We have a plan B, which is an online caravan with artists and other people that would be performing for 48 hours and people giving messages if we can't go out on the streets because it floods too much or something else happens. But, you know, it's amazing to see that the people that are struggling and looking for options are the most vulnerable and the most abandoned, like our artistic class, the singers, the people that work in theater, the musicians, the teachers, the line workers, the water authority people, common workers. Those are the ones that are trying to get the change, because the other ones are in their comfort zone, and they're, you know, they get paid. The politicians can't get paid no matter what. You know, they're totally out of touch. Most of them are totally out of touch with the people. They don't even imagine what it's like not to have food in their on their table. I mean, the Secretary of Education refused to serve food to the children. We're not talking about having the kids come in to eat. They wouldn't even have the kitchen set up and have takeouts for people to eat. That happened all over the United States. And he says that they don't have a legal obligation to feed the children. So, you know, kids that rely on their public schools to have breakfast and lunch in Puerto Rico have been struggling with food issues. And then mothers can't go to work because they have the kids. And, you know, there's other things happening in homes, not only in Puerto Rico, but in the United States. A lot of domestic violence has been going on, where people are locked up with no money and other issues in a crisis like the COVID has brought. And I don't really see anything happening on a level to help people deal with that. I think that on a general level, most places are totally ignoring that. There's nothing set up to help those people that find themselves in a situation like that.
Well, unfortunately, we run short of time today. I want to thank you personally. There hasn't been a time that I called to ask for your help and understanding what's going on, that you haven't made yourself available. And by making yourself available, you educate all of us about what is going on in Puerto Rico. And this is such a time. I want to thank you so much, Elisa, for your generosity and for your caring and for your work and your collaboration with us to help us get an accurate, on-the-ground understanding of what is going on. And we can see that it is not what is being printed in the papers, and you hear all these, you know, good things are happening, and things are getting better. And you give us a reality check that we definitely need. We will talk again soon.
Thank you so much.
Because there are questions, I'm sure. We just wanted to give you the opportunity to give us an overview and then we'll try to get together again to facilitate questions, specific questions that people have. I thank you again and greatly appreciate your generosity in terms of time and expertise and all the things that you have helped me with in trying to get the story translated in a way that people understand it. Don't go for what is being reported. This is the real deal. Thanks again.
Yep.
We will return at some point when we can coordinate our schedules so that you can have all of the time to ask your questions of Elisa. Bye-bye.